Portions of the day's programming are reproduced by means of electrical transcriptions or tape recording.
This is Budweiser's weekday sports beat.
Game over! Notre Dame knocks off number one!
Tell them what time it is.
We're going to keep getting back here. I'm sorry if you don't like it, and we're going to put ourselves back in this position again.
Pretty good.
With Sean Stiers.
Notre Dame is the national champion!
Fisher's going to keep it himself. Slips past a tackler and dives with one hand to the end zone. Touchdown, Mishawaka.
On Sports Radio 960 AM, WSBT.
The Bears are what we thought they were.
They are who we thought they were. And we let them off the hook.
He's running down the middle by the 50. He's at the 30. He's bare-chested and banging his chest. They're chasing him. They're not going to get him.
And now your host, Sean Stiers.
Well, hello there. How we doing today? Hope you're having a great day on what's been just a beautiful mid-October fall day here in Michiana. For the first time in 2 years, we can finally say it. Southern Cal Week is here. That's right. Notre Dame and USC coming up this Saturday at Notre Dame Stadium. Who knows exactly what we're going to get from either team? The Irish, the Trojans both coming off bye weeks last weekend. The fourth straight opponent to actually use their bye before playing Notre Dame this season. Notre Dame's 2-1 in those other two games, though. The loss, of course, to Cincinnati and a couple of fourth quarter comebacks against both Wisconsin and Virginia Tech. And this is going to be the second of three consecutive primetime games for the Irish as well. We had 7:30 kickoffs, of course, 2 weeks ago. Kicked off at 7:30 against Virginia Tech. Next week's home game against North Carolina is going to kick off at 7:30 as well. So here's what the coverage looks like Saturday right here on Sports Radio 960 AM WSBT. We start at 1 o'clock with a replay of the Brian Kelly Show. 2 o'clock, it's game day with Tim Growl and Vince D'Addario and their slew of guests. 4 o'clock, game day sports beat with Darren Pritchett and I. We'll go till 6:30 when the Notre Dame Radio Network's tailgate show takes over. 7:30 is the kickoff, and then the postgame show after the game. And this week, it'll be former Notre Dame wide receiver Bobby Brown joining me. He is filling in for Evan Sharpley, who won't be here this week. But Bobby Brown and I, his prerogative on the postgame show on Sports Radio 960 AM WSBT, and of course over on Sunny 101.5 as well. So just before the show got started this afternoon, some breaking news, and I don't know if you heard my Sports Center about 10 minutes ago, but Notre Dame quarterback Brendan Clark on Instagram this afternoon announced his intention to enter the transfer portal. Clark, of course, low on the depth chart after he suffered a knee injury last year. He missed all of spring practice. He was not able to practice again until about midway through fall training camp this season. Here is the statement that Brendan Clark released on Instagram within the last hour. Quote, first of all, I would like to thank Coach Kelly and the entire Notre Dame coaching staff for the opportunity to play football and go to school at such a prestigious university. I am beyond grateful for the experience and for the relationships that have been built over the past few years. However, it is in my best interest that I enter my name into the transfer portal. I am looking forward to this new journey, but I will always appreciate my time here in South Bend. Lovely, Brendan Clark, end quote. So that is Brendan Clark's statement on Instagram within the last hour. He played in just one game last year. He was 1-for-3 for 7 yards against Pittsburgh. Played against both Bowling Green and New Mexico as a true freshman in 2019. And, I mean, look at where we are right now. If Brendan Clark was healthy, maybe he's ahead of Drew Pine. I don't know. It would be just, you know, one more kind of ingredient in what has become a very convoluted recipe at the quarterback position so far this fall. But Brendan Clark has not been healthy. Again, the knee injury, and Notre Dame has already used three quarterbacks this season, and Brendan Clark essentially saying, hey, I want to play too. And looking at what's going on right now, the odds of that happening here at Notre Dame are slim and none. Here is what is left at the quarterback position now for Notre Dame. Of course, you've got Jack Cohn. This will be his only year at Notre Dame, the grad transfer from Wisconsin. Then you've got the freshman, Tyler Buckner. You've got the sophomore, Drew Pine. And then you also have Ron Paulus, the third, the local guy, son of Ron Paulus, of course, who is a freshman as well. So you still have four, and then you've got, of course, more coming in next year, depending on who it happens to be, because there's always, there's all kinds of stuff going on with recruiting right now. Steve Angeli, supposed to be here in the near future, but they're recruiting this kid from LSU, and I'm curious to see if that kicks up even more with the news of it. And Orgeron being out there, the LSU commit. So, you know, you still have four scholarship quarterbacks on the roster right now. Going into next year, you'll have four as well. So, all the best to Brendan Clark, who is leaving. You do kind of always wonder about the timing of the thing. They're at the semester break right now. Why he would announce it right now, I guess he obviously, whatever reps he is getting. It is interesting that Brian Kelly mentioned Brendan Clark when they were talking about the quarterback and developing and all that stuff. And you'll hear some of Brian Kelly's comments about the quarterbacks from his press conference. But Brendan Clark is now a former Notre Dame football player. A lot of people, of course, think Drew Pine is going to soon be a former Notre Dame football player. But look, you don't know what's in Drew Pine's mind and what he's thinking about, because by the time January rolls around, whenever Notre Dame plays its bowl game, whatever date that it happens to be, the day after that, Jack Cohn's not on the roster anymore. And now it is Drew Pine along with Tyler Buchner and Ron Paulus in the spring. At that point, you know, after this season's over, day after the bowl game, it's all about competing for the starting job for next year in the spring. And Pine went through that last spring. He got himself close, but not close enough. You could argue that based on the state of this team, as we've talked about with the offensive line and everything else, that maybe Drew Pine and his added mobility are more in line with what Brian Kelly wants. But Brian Kelly, as he has shown throughout the course of his career, likes experience. He's got experience with Jack Cohn. He has a lot of experience with Jack Cohn. He has little experience with Tyler Buchner, and then he's got everything in between. So, you know, the Irish have played three quarterbacks this season. Cohn has started all six, with Pine and Buchner seeing varying degrees of playing time. So Brian Kelly, at his press conference this week, asked, what is the next step for the quarterback position?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, from a quarterback standpoint, you know, Jack Cohn continues to be the guy that we feel like gives us the best chance to win, and mixture of him with Tyler Buchner. You know, I think both of them. Drew has done some really good things for us, and if we feel like we're in a situation where we need to call on him, we would. But I think right now, as we look at it, it's probably – in my mind, and I know in Tommy's, that Jack would start, and we'll continue to get Tyler more playing time.
So Jack will start, and Tyler Buchner will continue to get more playing time. The answer from Brian Kelly and his latest press conference, and so this will be every game this season, assuming that this sticks until Saturday. And based on the track record that we've got right now, there's no reason to believe it won't. Jack Cohn will be 7-for-7 in terms of starts this year. And of course, we know there have been times like Florida State and Toledo where Notre Dame came right out of the chute with Jack Cohn and drove it right down the field and stuck it in the end zone. Back-to-back games, opening possession right into the end zone. There have been other games this year like Cincinnati where it looked like they were going to drive it right down the field and stick it in the end zone, but not so fast. Tap the brakes. Interception. And then, of course, not quite as bad, not interception bad, 2 weeks ago against Virginia Tech, but three and out to start, three straight punts, 2 3 and outs on the first three possessions. Jack Cohn is out after going 2-for-3 for 15 yards on Notre Dame's first three drives against the Hokies. Enter Tyler Buchner. Buchner started out great, but that tapered with his two interceptions. Here comes Jack Cohn after Buckner's injury. Cohn goes 9-of-12. 108 yards with a touchdown. The rest is history as he leads the comeback. And, you know, Notre Dame comes from behind to defeat Virginia Tech after a touchdown, a two-point conversion, and a field goal. So the question, I think, is if you're going with Jack Cohn, and it's not just that I think it is, it's that that was the question that was asked. If you're going with Jack Cohn, how do you get him to play the way that he did at the end of the Virginia Tech game? I think we'd all like to know that, right? Can you replicate that? Do you change the kind of plays that he runs, or does he just need to play better? How do you get the most out of him?
I think it's a little bit of both. You know, let's look at it from this perspective, right? When has he looked really good late in the game, right? You know, those defensive linemen are chasing Tyler Buckner around, right? They're tiring out a little bit. So that pass rush is not quite the same in the first series or the second series as it is in that last series. So, you know, there's a little bit of that. Jack speeds up a little bit in those late drives where the ball comes out a little bit quicker. There's more of a sense of urgency. So I think it's a little bit of both. I think the pass rush tends to lay down a little bit later in the game as those guys are running sideline to sideline, having to chase all game. And then I think Jack's sense of urgency in terms of getting the ball out is a lot more deliberate. So I think we gleaned a lot from that in our bye week in terms of what we needed to work on maybe earlier in the game for, you know, Jack and being more efficient.
All right. So, you know, he's agreeing. And I think that, I mean, if you watch it, of course, you know, it's there. We all saw it. So he didn't come out and say, yeah, we're going to run more tempo, because he doesn't want USC to know what they're going to do, obviously. But that kind of gives me some hope that maybe we're going to see more tempo. Now, I agree, defensive linemen chasing Buckner around and all that stuff, and it's the fourth quarter, and they are more tired by the fourth quarter. That is all true. But you're also playing more prevent defense. You're playing more soft zone, you know, and that kind of thing as well. And because you're going more tempo, that does the defensive line, you know, not quite as effective and all that stuff. That's all true. But, you know, the biggest thing is Jack Cohn standing in there making quick decisions. That's the biggest thing. Now, can he do that? But again, part of that also goes to play calling, you know, route concepts, all those different things that we've talked about over the last few weeks. With it's not just enough to say, okay, we're going tempo, because to go true tempo, for him to be able to get the ball out quicker, to do all those different things, you know, kind of like rapid fire, you know, Ian Book type stuff. Sometimes when Ian Book was at his peak, to be able to get it out, you need some shorter routes, and it's something that we've talked over and over about. You can't have every route starting at 10 yards downfield. You have to have some slants. You have to have, you know, some hot route concepts, because teams are blitzing all the time with all the sacks that Notre Dame has given up, whether it's corner fires or middle linebacker blitz or safety blitz, whatever it happens to be, they're getting blitzed all the time. And it happens early, because as much as Notre Dame has driven down and scored on opening possessions, Jack Cohn, for two or three games in a row, was also sacked on the very first dropback that he had of the game. So we'll see. We'll see exactly how it looks differently. But if you're going to go, if you're sticking with Jack Cohn, you definitely, there has to be some adaptation, whether it is him getting it into his head, you know, again, playing better, whatever it happens to be, the kind of plays that are called for him, the kind of route concepts that are called for him, all of the above. It has to look different if Jack Cohn is going to stay out there. Otherwise, it makes no sense. But then, as Brian Kelly also said, there's also going to be more Tyler Buckner. And when Tyler Buckner was in the game 2 weeks ago against Virginia Tech, Notre Dame ran the football much better than when Jack Cohn was in the game. And in fact, they ran it better than they've ran it all season. They ended up with 180 net rushing yards against the Hokies. So how do you run the ball better with Jack Cohn in the game?
Yeah, I think it's a process for us that we feel better about right now. I think we, you know, obviously we've made some changes on the offensive line. We think personnel makes a difference. We think that, you know, certainly Tyler adds a little bit more balance there, because when you have to defend the quarterback, obviously he gets you more diversity. But I think you're going to continue to see an uptick in terms of the running game and its consistency. And that's what we're looking for.
See, and that's, I mean, like he's talking about the more diversity that Buckner gives. I mean, that's obviously why everyone wanted to see Drew Pine. It's because Drew Pine he was only a 50% passer against Wisconsin, but he could keep plays alive with his legs. He could elude the rush a little bit better than Jack Cohn could. And would it completely open up the running game? I don't know. But the other part of that is what also opened up the running game, it was not just Buckner's running ability. It was also when he hit the shot downfield to Kevin Austin on the first drive. I mean, that completely altered things because now Virginia Tech has to respect the deep ball. That's something that they had not shown Buckner do on any game film going into that. That was like going back to Toledo. That was the element of surprise because even on the long, quote unquote, long passes that he had, it was, you know, the ball out to Chris Tyree, the catch and run from Tyree. It was Tyree doing most of the work after the fact. But Kyren Williams ends up with 81 yards on 19 carries against Virginia Tech. Tyler Buckner, 12 carries for 67 yards. Logan Diggs had a good game himself, the freshman making his debut, 6 carries for 29 yards. And then Tyree, before his injury, 3 carries for 12 yards. So now that also plays into this because one other thing they've done this week with Joe Walt taking over that left tackle spot, Michael Carmody was there for a couple of games, and of course Taj Baker was there for a couple of games as well. Now it is on to Joe Alt, and Alt's career basically started as an H-back type guy, kind of trying to take that Tommy Trimble role from last year. That's what it started out as, you know, more as a hybrid tackle slash tight end, but now that's what Michael Carmody is going to be. So they're going to have some size there. So is moving Carmody to tight end, does it help kind of get through until Kevin Bauman comes back? Because Brian Kelly updated Bauman, the guy who was injured during training camp, who was really making a name for himself in red zone opportunities during training camp. He was like Chris Carter. All he did was catch touchdown passes. You know, does it help them get through until he comes back, which is looking like it's going to be 2 weeks away? Does it help him get through with Mitchell Evans, the other tight end, being out? Because remember, Mitchell Evans in the second half against Virginia Tech called for targeting, and so he was tossed out of the game, which means he has to sit for the first half of this one. Or could the Carmody move be long-term as well? How's Brian Kelly looking at this whole thing?
I think that's all of that, a combination of all of those things. And I think that, with Alt, being the left tackle, now Carmody kind of slips into that, little bit of do a little bit of everything for us. Mm-hmm. So I think that kind of services that role for us. And, he's a big guy that can add some size into that 13 package for us too. Now, when Bowman comes back, we'll see where we are. But for the immediate purpose of, needing that next tight end, he definitely serves a great role there for us.
So the 13 package is, it sounds like, and just to kind of, I realize sometimes with all the coach speak and all that stuff, 11 personnel, 1 running back, 1 tight end. 12 personnel, 1 running back, 2 tight ends. 13, 1 running back, 3 tight ends. Personally, not a fan of 13 right now with where this team is and the things that we just talked about with what Jack Cohn needs to do to be more efficient. Granted, if you've got 13 personnel, that probably means maybe Mayer is split out as a receiver someplace, and then you've got 2 more tight ends in for pass protection, but it also limits the number of receivers that you have going downfield. So it either telegraphs that you're going to try to power block and run the ball up front, or it limits what you're able to do in the passing game. So especially if Carmody is that third tight end. So not a fan of that right now. I think that there are other things that they can do. Now, part of that as well maybe is personnel driven with what you've got at wide receiver, even though you can use Kyren Williams as a wide receiver. And, what the status of Chris Tyree, it looks like Tyree's going to be back. But there are different things you can do. 3 tight ends, not a fan of it right now. I wish we would see less of it. Again, because of the issues that they are facing with the quarterback and trying to get him into a better groove, passing the ball, not a fan of that. But it sounds like we're going to see that this Saturday. So we shall see there. as well. We're going to take a timeout right now. When we come back, we're going to talk a little USC football with RJ Abatia from uscfootball.com. Budweiser's weekday sports beat is brought to you by Budweiser, the king of beers, locally distributed by United Beverage Company of South Bend. Football fans, this bun's for you. The Food Bank of Northern Indiana. Hunger's a story we can end. Find out how at feedindiana.org. Tim Grau, State Farm Insurance. You need life insurance today. Tomorrow will be too late. Protect your family by calling Tim at 232-9981. Midland Engineering Company, completing their first century of quality roofing experience. Mishawaka Education Foundation, granting a better future. Barnaby's of Mishawaka and Granger, serving Michiana's most favorite pizza for both dine-in and carry-out. Fisher's Barbecue and Catering, East McKinley Avenue in Mishawaka. Drive-thru open Tuesday through Saturday. Just look for the smoke. South Bend Orthopedics, team physicians for the University of Notre Dame since 1949. Wings Etc. Grill and Pub with 14 Michiana area locations. Stop in today or order online at togo.wingsetc.com. Four Winds Casino, your entertainment escape. Legacy Heating and Air, your heating and clean air specialists. And Mimo's Pizza on Edison in Mishawaka. Time out. Then we're going to talk a little USC football as we preview the Trojans. That's coming up next on Budweiser's Weekday Sports Beat. Budweiser's Weekday Sports Beat continues on Sports Radio 960 AM WSBT. I was saying earlier, Dodgers and Braves were getting going. They had an interesting start time today, 5:08 Eastern time, and currently in the bottom of the first, the Dodgers lead the Braves 2-0. And with us right now from sunny California is RJ Abatia. He covers USC for uscfootball.com. Are you watching that baseball game right now, RJ?
I am streaming it as we speak from deep within Heritage Hall. So it's
nice.
It's all happening here today.
All right. Sounds good. Well, it's good to talk to you once again. And, you know, it's as far as these two old rivals, it's been a couple of years since Notre Dame and USC, of course, have played, since they didn't get to play due to the pandemic last year. Are Trojan fans, are they pretty fired up about the chance to see and play Notre Dame this weekend?
I think they're about as fired up as they can be during a season that I think has been an unquestioned disappointment and a little bit too dramatic off the field for I think any of their liking. I mean,
right.
This game speaks for itself. I mean, cliche, throw the records out, blah, blah, blah. You don't need to really explain to anybody why you should want to watch this game regardless. But I think even given all that, I think that enthusiasm might be just a little bit tempered because I think the expectations are just not really high for USC right now.
Let's go back to the decision to fire Clay Helton. It was just 2 weeks into the season, of course, you know, after USC had lost at home to Stanford. What did you think of the timing of the whole thing to do it after 2 weeks?
I mean, look, in a real sense, there's never a categorically good time to do that. But given that reality, there's probably not a worse time to do it than when USC did it, simply because, you know, the interim coach, it's not like he's only got to hold the fort for 3 or 4 more weeks and just get to the end of a season.
Exactly.
You know, Dante Williams came on and he's got to hold things together for 10 games. And it obviously begs the question of, you know, you gave him only 2 games. You know, what did you know about him 2 games in that you didn't know before training camp started,
yeah,
that you didn't know
thought.
In the spring? You know, it's just not – look, the presumption, cynical as it is that when you hire a new athletic director, you are hiring him to make a football hire at some point, you know, unless he comes on in the midst of some super successful tenured guy. So, you know, Mike Bone, who has been here for, you know, a couple years, and, you know, you have to think that the process was at some point they were going to have to move on from Clay Helton. Everybody kind of knew it. The writing was just graffitied on the walls at
sure.
this point. And so given all of that, it was very peculiar timing, and it's kind of hard to argue that it has worked out very well for USC within the context of this season.
Well, Brian Kelly was asked this week, have they been a better team since they gave the interim title to Dante Williams? What do you think?
I think it's kind of hard to argue that they have. I mean, they were blown out by Stanford, and Helton was relieved of his duties. And since then, they've gone on the road and beaten a mediocre to decent Washington State team. They've got a winning record in a conference, and just a categorically terrible Colorado team on the road. And at the Coliseum, they have been blown off the field by Oregon State and Utah in historic wins. Utah had not won since the Wilson administration in the Coliseum. And Oregon State had not won. I'm not even giving the years out. You Notre Dame guys are smart. You gotta be educated. You're gonna have to figure out the year. But Oregon State had not won since the Kennedy administration. So, you know, I mean, that has all happened since Williams took over. And to be honest with you, as I said, it's a tough chore to be handed this job under these circumstances. So, to be honest with you, I don't know that those results are any different whether Clay Helton's there or not.
Well, I'm curious. This isn't necessarily about USC, but just real quick, the state of the Pac-12 right now, because I think that probably we're seven into the season, and I think maybe four different teams have made a case at one point or another as the best team in the conference. Who do you think is the best team in the Pac-12 right now?
Let's just call it a fluid reality.
Okay, so that's kind of what I was thinking.
because look, I mean, I think everybody was on the Oregon bandwagon.
Sure.
After they beat Ohio State on the road. I think it kind of remains to be seen how quality a win that was, but that's still a pretty solid win, you would think. But they have gone on to struggle in games since then. And they've got quarterback issues, and it's kind of tough to back a team with quarterback issues.
Yeah.
Until last week, Arizona State had kind of seized the day by beating UCLA, getting on a little bit of a roll themselves, looking strong, and then Utah just punched them in the mouth last Saturday. So I don't know that there's an answer. And look, the Pac-12 glass full interpretation is, wow, look, we've got a truly – competitive conference where everyone can beat everybody. And yeah, that's absolutely true. You have to say that. But the half empty is, you know, they've basically cannibalized themselves into irrelevance before the season's halfway over, if you're talking about the playoff or even, you know, New Year's Six Bowl.
Yeah, I think the real reality is they would like a team to be dominant so that they could get back, you know, so they could get into the college football playoff. But that appears like maybe another year away from happening already at this point. So, RJ Abatia with us from USCFootball.com. Speaking of quarterbacks, Keaton Slovis, his third year now as a starter for the Trojans. He looks, just kind of from the outside looking in, like a guy kind of stuck in idle a little bit. 9 touchdowns, 5 interceptions, completing 64% of his passes. How do you evaluate Slovis's play so far?
I think idle is a fair way to describe it. I think on the list of USC's problems, he is not very high up.
Okay.
But I think when you're talking about a guy who came in with, you know, Heisman hype, all-conference hype, he's definitely not meeting those benchmarks. And, you know, part of it was he got hurt in the Washington State game. Freshman quarterback Jackson Dart came in and help lead them to a win. That got everybody excited about Jackson Dart. Then Jackson Dart was revealed to be hurt in that game. And Slovis kind of has come back. He delivered in the win against Colorado. But, again, he was not part of the problem, I think, to a large extent against Utah and Oregon State. But he also wasn't part of the solution either. And I think, again, that idling is a good way to describe it. I mean, his completion percentage is down 64% from a career of 69. So that's, you know, that's one or two completions a game that's off the mark. But his yards per attempt are down almost 2 yards down from what it was his freshman year. So it's really hard to argue that he has progressed significantly. And this USC passing game is putting up semi-respectable numbers, but I think like the USC offense on a whole, what's killing them is they're just not finishing drives.
So, you know, you kind of led me into my next part of that then, because it doesn't matter who's in charge or how good they are. It seems like USC always has like that NFL caliber wide receiver, and it's Drake London this year. 64 catches, over 800 yards. What makes Drake London so good?
You know, Graham Harrell has been asked that question almost weekly, and his answer is some version of everything, and that's not far off. Okay. He is big. He is polished in terms of route running, breaks, understanding the subtleties of the game. His ball skills are unbelievable. You know, 50-50 balls are not 50-50 balls when Drake London's involved. I don't think he's got blinding NFL speed, but he's certainly got enough speed that, you know, if you hesitate, you've lost him. And so, yeah, he has been fantastic. And that's even before you factor in the fact that he is getting double and even occasionally triple teamed, you know, on an every snap basis. You know, he is a legit problem. There's just no other way to slice it. And like I said, like, you can do your job against him and still give up the completion, you know, which I think kind of wears on you if you're a cornerback over the course of a game when you're kind of where you need to be, and it kind of just doesn't matter, you know. So he has been everything that he was expected to be.
So I think what everyone, you know, from a Notre Dame perspective wants to know is, how did Stanford hold him to 4 catches and 68 yards, which is just well below anything that he is averaging this year?
I mean, that game is going to probably be the entirety of Caillou Blue Kelly's draft film, to be honest with you. Like, because, yeah, it is a clear outlier. I mean, Stanford, I don't think Stanford did anything really magical against him, but they just had some guys who played really well. And, you know, that game was just a weird game for USC in a sense. I think they got down in a way they didn't expect to get down, and it, you know, it changes. You know, the thing, the final scores of these USC losses don't look as bad as the way they've played out. I mean, USC has been down 4 and 5 scores at points in these games, you know, and when you get into that situation, you know, those are possession after possession where the defenses are pinning their ears back. They can pass rush with no fear. And the coverages can be as, you know, complicated and involve as many guys as you want, because you're not stressed out about getting beat in the run game.
Yeah. RJ Abatey is with us from USCFootball.com. Now there's another Drake Jackson, outside linebacker, their leading sack guy, maybe their best defensive player. He was injured a couple of weeks ago against Utah. What's his status for this week right now?
So USC had a bye week, so we haven't had an update on Drake Jackson in a week. We'll have one today from Dante Williams, but the expectation as of right now is I would expect him to be there and be playing. Like I said, that is literally just a couple hours away from being updated. Sadly, I don't think, not even you and I could vamp for that long, so I don't think I'm going to be able to
get
back to you on that.
That's okay.
But it'll be out on Twitter. It won't be a big secret. But I think
I think we're losing. RJ, can you still hear me right now?
Sorry, you jumped out for 1 second, but you're back.
Okay, you did too. We both jumped out for a second. I'll tell you what. Let me kind of start to put a wrap on it with this. You know, you mentioned that Keaton Slovis was not close to being on USC's list of problems this year, and obviously putting the coaching thing aside, because when you fire your coach in week two, that's obviously going to be a problem. But if you could maybe kind of hit one or two of the top problems on each side of the ball that they have, that you would say is predominant so far, what would they be?
Yeah, I mean, I think I kind of gave it away on offense. It's really just the red zone for the offense. I mean, they are 53rd in the country in red zone trips. So that's better than half, right? Better than average. So they're moving the ball at a respectable clip, even if it's not an elite clip. but they just are not scoring. They have a 57% touchdown percentage in the red zone. That's 86th in the country. And it has cost them. You know, it has cost them in the Stanford game and the Utah game and even the Oregon State game, where there were some early drives that ended in opponent's territory and did not end in touchdowns. And when you're struggling on defense, that is a problem. And that kind of leads me to the other side of the ball, which, you know, I think the biggest surprise in terms of USC struggling this year has been their defense. I think this was a secondary that was expected to be amongst the best. And then their run defense, the defensive line, was expected to be a solid part of this team, and they are 85th in rush defense in terms of yards per carry allowed. So the defense has underachieved, and there were a couple injuries in spring. They lost Brandon Peely, who was a big part of their interior defensive line plans. They lost Jay Toya, who transferred to UCLA for spring ball, and he was going to be a rotation guy for them. So they've kind of been lacking that interior defensive tackle, nose guard presence, and it's kind of opened up the door to all the other kinds of problems, because you struggle with the run game if you don't have that. It's a little bit harder to get a pass rush if you don't have that. And then if you're not getting the pass rush, you've got defensive backs in one-on-one situations, and they can't hold on forever. So I think those are the kind of the big glaring things that have kind of bitten USC. And I think from a talent standpoint, certainly, I think there's, you can argue they've underachieved just relative to what they have.
Right. RJ Abadia, USCfootball.com. Hey, RJ, appreciate it as always. Sounds like you're plenty busy out there getting ready to find out some more USC information. So appreciate your time as always, and look forward to talking to you again sometime.
No problem. Thanks for having me. Have a great one.
All right. Absolutely. You too. RJ Abadia from USCfootball.com. We'll take a timeout. When we come back, the My 5 question of the day on Budweiser's Weekday Sports Beat.
This is the My 5 question of the day.
Can you dig it?
On Sports Radio 960 AM WSBT.
Today's My 5 question of the day: the 5 most surprising NFL football teams, both good and a bad way this season. Number 5 most surprising team, the 2-3 Seattle Seahawks. Now, of course, they miss Russell Wilson, for sure. But even before Wilson was injured, they were still sputtering. And, you know, the offense has been inconsistent. The defense is giving up just under 30 points a game. Just not the Legion of Boom anymore. Bottom line, they finished first or second in the NFC West for 9 straight years, and they are currently in last place and supposedly looking to bring in another quarterback with Russell Wilson injured and Geno Smith not playing any better than he has. Number 4 most surprising team, the 3-3 Cleveland Browns. And now, I kind of had a hard time deciding where to put Cleveland, because I did have my concerns about just how well they would play this year after they made the playoffs. And, you know, last year there were legitimate expectations coming into this year. They played a tough schedule, losing to Kansas City, the Chargers, and the Cardinals. But Baker Mayfield's injured now. So is Jeremiah Owusu-Koramoah. So is half of their team, it seems like, right now. So it's going to be really interesting with them playing this Thursday night against the Broncos. Number 3 is the 6-0 Arizona Cardinals. In the last couple years, I've been saying, watch out for Arizona. And, you know, now they're the only unbeaten team left in the NFL. Their schedule hasn't been the absolute toughest, but they do have divisional wins over both the Rams and 49ers. It's the Rams' only loss so far. Their defense has been most impressive, I think, because they've only allowed more than 20 points just once this season. You knew you were going to have Kyler Murray, and their offense has been more consistent this year as well than Kyler Murray just running around and making plays like he's done the last couple of years. Number 2 most surprising team, another 3-3 team, the Kansas City Chiefs. Of course, they've been to the Super Bowl 2 years in a row, so the fact that they're 500 through 6 games is just a shock, even though maybe it shouldn't be, because they lost the Super Bowl last year, and teams that lose the Super Bowl getting back to the Super Bowl the next year, that has been the big uphill climb over the last 20, 30 years in the NFL. Patrick Mahomes, though, has already thrown 8 interceptions. The most he's ever thrown in a season is 12. That was 3 years ago, the year he threw 50 touchdowns. He had all of 6 interceptions last year, so that has got to get better. And the number one most surprising team, again, whether it's good or whether it's bad, the 1-5 Miami Dolphins. They were 10-6 and just missed the playoffs last year. But they're definitively the worst team in the NFL right now. And I can say that safely because they just lost to a Jacksonville team that had lost 20 straight games before they beat the Dolphins Sunday in London. There's no more Fitzmagic. It's Tua and Jacoby Brissett, and they're not good. So the Miami Dolphins top my list of the most surprising teams in the NFL, and obviously not in a good way. Going to take a timeout. When we come back, I've got a SportsCenter update. Again, some breaking news out of Notre Dame. A quarterback has entered his name into the transfer portal. Who is it? I will tell you that coming up next. And then in the 6 o'clock hour, Bobby Hensley joins me for Rapid Fire. That's coming up on Budweiser's Weekday Sports Beat.
You're listening to Budweiser's Weekday Sports Beat with Sean Stiers on Sports Radio 960 AM WSBT.
It's hour two of Budweiser's Weekday Sports Beat on this Tuesday. You can push a button over there. There you go. See?
You've always had it set up for me, so I've never had to do it. And I want you to hear my words. They're valuable. I was trying to be subtle.
I have to give you the illusion of free will, right?
Yeah.
That's okay. Where it is.
Yeah. All right. Well, after we trolled the top five, or my five, whatever, it's fine.
You're not happy with my Miami Dolphins as the most surprisingly bad
well,
team in the
you
NFL,
didn't say bad.
Huh?
You said
well, the
good.
most surprising team.
You
most
said
surprising.
Good or bad.
But they just happen to be on the bad side.
I don't think that's surprising. Anyway, we can get into that later if you want.
Whatever. We can do
I
it now.
I think that
can
that's not
later.
Surprising at all. The Dolphins are terrible.
Well, you're a Dolphins fan.
Sure.
So you've been down on Tua to begin with.
I have.
Okay.
So when were they good last year?
Well, they were 10-6.
When Fitzpatrick was playing.
Well, yeah. Okay. I see what you're saying. And I said no Fitzmagic.
They had no right? Fitzmagic. Devontae Parker was out. Their running game is garbage. Their offensive line, that was only the second game they've had the same five.
Look, I said this before. The Colts right now, I don't think they'd be 2-4 if they had signed Fitzmagic instead of making the trade for Carson Wentz.
It was, well, we've both been on against Carson Wentz kind of, so. But
now, that obviously would have been a stopgap short-term deal, but.
And if you really want to get in your top five, and I think the biggest surprise might be the Cowboys.
No.
Because you're a homer on them. No. I'm a homer on the Dolphins, and I've always been down on them. But you, skeptical. I think Ezekiel Elliott looks like he's running through harder than I expected. He's making
he's
spins.
Playing better.
He's doing way better.
But what surprises me about the Cowboys talk is people are surprised that the offense is playing as well. Now, you can
but
you
they
can
got
include,
Dak
you
back.
Can include, right, because in the four and a half games that Dak was playing, the frickin' offense was averaging over 30 points a game last year. It was the defense that was – that's the only – that's
– Jalen
that,
Smith.
That – well – where is he now? Yeah, and so I missed a tackle the other day against the Bears, by the way, and then didn't see him too much after that.
Yeah, but
and I'm
Bears
not
are.
I'm not like gloating in that, but I told you, right?
Mm-hmm.
I told you.
Yeah.
That's all I can say.
No, but I mean, obviously you've watched every Cowboys game because that's your team, but like seeing Jalen and then what happened there.
You can make a case that the defense is surprising because it's kind of like the turnaround from Brian Van Gorder to Mike Elko in 1 year for Notre Dame. Like that's they were Dallas's defense was that historically bad last year. Now they're not historically good.
And
they're
their division out by is historically bad.
Well, but they're so, but they haven't even played. They've only played
that's what I'm saying. Yeah.
Like two of those teams so far. The you know, like their only loss is to Tampa Bay.
So there's a lot of wins still to come for them.
Hopefully. They still have to play like the Cardinals. They've got a, you know, they've got some teams that they've got to
and
play.
And I'm not
still
saying
too.
It's surprising. So you got your quarterback back, but that's a huge question mark. So I think that should be one of the surprises. Maybe not number one, but
they
should be up there.
They were originally going to be my number five. I was going to include them on there. And then let me scroll back and look at my list here. I ended up, I replaced them with Seattle because I thought about it.
That's a tough one
because
that division's incredible.
But as I said,
they haven't played it.
You were listening to it. Yep. They have finished first or second in the NFC West for 9 straight years. And the fact that they're sitting there in last place right now, that's like if they were even in third place, I probably would have left them off the list.
Yeah, they're in last place. How many games in are we? 5?
Still in last place.
Yeah.
6-0. They're not going to finish in first.
They were also a 7-9 team that made the playoffs and won a game.
But that was how many years ago?
Well, okay. But I'm just saying.
But that was when that division was bad.
So. Sure. Absolutely. That's why they won it at 7-9. It was almost the NFC least of last year.
Yeah.
But I don't know. It's still so early in that NFL. Plus, they have an extra game this year.
Right.
So that changes a little bit. Yeah. I mean, 1/17 of that changes now.
Maybe signing Cam Newton will put them over the top, right?
Mm-hmm. Is that what they're looking at?
Apparently. Pete Carroll has said that, you know, they're considering other quarterbacks, and you know, there was some conversation, I believe, with Cam Newton last year before Newton ended up signing with New England. So
you want one of the least efficient quarterbacks in NFL history.
Well, I'm not a Seahawks fan.
Well, I'm not a Cam Newton fan.
Yeah, I mean,
he's got a small skill set, so like why?
He does.
And that skill set isn't what they need in Seattle.
And it shrunk considering he couldn't throw the ball downfield last year.
Right.
Yeah.
And then if you look at Seattle, they have so many playmakers. Like they could. I mean, they have Josh Gordon.
DK
Metcalf. Oh, no, Josh Gordon went to Kansas City. They have DK Metcalf, and they have, remember the other guy's name? Lockett.
Yeah.
And they can stretch the field. Mm-hmm. But their running backs are all on the injured list as well.
Yeah, and that's like two or three years in a row. Their running backs just that's a big thing because I was on my for fantasy. I was looking and there's some guy that I've never heard of, but like he's the guy. Right? But my fantasy team, by the way,
not great.
Well, no, it's actually good. But I've got like 5 guys on a bye this week, and then 2 others who are out due to injury as well. So I've got to like revamp my whole roster in a week to try not to.
But then you got to drop guys that you want to keep.
Yeah, exactly.
And give them up for the league. So,
exactly.
But that Seattle team's, I think they're going to be okay by the end. And when Russell Wilson comes back, they're going to be okay. They're going to be better than San Francisco. They might not be better than Arizona.
Well, so we've chewed up most of this segment at this point. The last question of the night was going to be, what was it going to be for
the most disappointing team in the NFL?
The most disappointing. Just go ahead and tell me who your most disappointing team in the NFL is right now.
Kansas City Chiefs.
Okay. So I was going to say. Yeah. So you said it's not the Dolphins because
that was expected.
It was to be expected.
I think it's expected. I think Tua was garbage from the beginning. But Kansas City.
I thought they'd at least be around. Now, nobody can be .500 anymore unless you have a tie because of the extra game. But
right.
Yeah, I mean, I had Kansas City as my number two, so we're not that far off.
But Kansas City, they're still going to be favored in almost every game.
Yeah.
I don't know if somebody figured them out.
The defense is not good.
And the defense is bad. And secondary.
Patrick Mahomes is forcing stuff. And now did you see Patrick Mahomes' mom is tweeting about how the interception the other day was not his fault because it hit off Tyreek Hill. You know, it bounced off Tyreek's hand and all that. No, you're right. But it's like.
I know. Now, they're just in chaos.
Yeah, and the NFL Network is like.
Picking it up and running with
putting Patrick Mahomes' mom's tweets on the on.
Now was that
TV.
Worse than McNabb's mom having the Campbell Soup commercials?
Yes.
No. So I get it, but like I think Kansas City's that gotta be because they were I mean, I know that I understand that you said the Super Bowl hangover,
right?
But you gotta
lose the Super Bowl. It's tougher to get back the next
but
year.
You can't
no, you're
be
right.
A game behind your whole division.
I agree. Because the whole division is at least a little bit better this year. The Chargers look like a legit team to beat. Raiders are going to be
in chaos
now. Yep. The Broncos started hot. They didn't play anybody. They've come back to earth. This is a big game for the Broncos against Cleveland with half of Cleveland's roster.
Both of those teams.
Yeah. That could be like almost an early play-in game for the playoffs. Like you win that game. That could end up deciding things one way or the other.
How weak does the AFC look right now?
And it's crazy because last year it was the NFC that was horrible. And this year, like when you look at how top-heavy the NFC – now, well, you're rolling your eyes at me over there, but there are a lot of good teams in the NFC right now.
I'm not rolling my eyes at that. I'm rolling my eyes at like how bad the AFC is.
Okay. Dallas 5-1, Green Bay 5-1, Tampa Bay 5-1, the Cardinals 6-0, the Rams 5-1. And I mean, that's like
they're all keeping pace with each other.
If you started the playoffs today, that would be a heck of a knockout pool as far as the NFC playoffs, wouldn't it?
It would absolutely.
You're talking about some really good games right there.
But you also have a lot of really bad teams in the NFC.
True.
Look at the Giants. Look at the Lions.
And the Seahawks are actually 2-4. I had that wrong. I think I listed them at 2-3, but they are 2-4 right now. So it's even worse than I said.
So they might be the best 2-4 team in the history of football.
No.
Yeah. They'll be up there.
The Seahawks are not making the playoffs this year.
They're not going to make the playoffs, but at the end of the year, they might be close to 7 or 8 wins.
Okay. I mean, obviously, nobody's surprised by the Lions being 0-6.
Well,
you should at least
be
happy.
And the Vikings are terrible. The NFC East is terrible. So
they're
like
not
you
terrible.
Have,
they're three. The Vikings are 3-3. They're just like, I can't figure that team out.
Well, Kirk Cousins has always been that guy. When you count on him, he's going to be terrible. Yeah. When you don't count on him, he's going to win games.
That's very true. All right, let's take a timeout. When we come back, we'll talk some Notre Dame quarterbacks. We'll talk about at least three of four Notre Dame
quarterbacks. Well, there's only three left.
Actually, we might talk about all of them. Yeah. I don't know. With the announcement today that Brendan Clark is going to enter the transfer portal. So we will do that when we return. Budweiser's Weekday Sports Beat and Rapid Fire comes up next on Sports Radio 960 AM WSBT.
Rapid Fire starts now on Sports Radio 960 AM WSBT. And now your host, Sean Stiers.
Rapid Fire time along with Bobby Hensley tonight. We've got a lot of Notre Dame quarterback conversation. Brendan Clark entered the transfer portal today. He had a knee injury last year, missed all of spring practice. Wasn't able to start practicing until midway through training camp. So he was essentially, at best, the fourth string guy, if not even fifth string with Ron Paulus out there, because I don't know exactly what his health was. When we saw him, we saw the first practice that he had. He had a knee brace on. He was not moving well, wasn't even able to do all the stuff
the
other quarterbacks were doing. So, Bobby, big deal, little deal. Brendan Clark entering the transfer portal.
Little deal. I mean, you got three guys ahead of him definitively on the depth chart.
Yes.
And beyond that, looking at the future, you still don't have him as number one next year. So, that's not a big deal at all.
Yeah, I mean, best.
He was just a roster guy.
Yeah, I mean, best case for him at this point was he would go into spring, have a chance with no Jack Cohn here, have a chance to compete with Buckner and Pine. But just where
compete,
he is right now.
Not even beat him.
Right.
Probably not.
Best case, best case, he was probably going to be number two in some fashion behind one of the. That's best case.
It's hard to even see that.
He was probably going to come out of the spring, so I think he's better off now. He can transfer at semester. He can do this early enough. Now he's got a chance. Get himself into the transfer portal.
Go to a MAC school.
Or wherever.
Play there.
Yeah.
So, like, what's the end game here?
Go to Kansas.
He's above that, I bet.
Whoa, now you hurt me.
Yeah, I'm doing that on purpose. No, but, like, if your goal is to be playing and get seen, you're going to want to go somewhere else.
Yeah.
And it might be a MAC school. It might be a Kansas. It might be the Big 12. Might be a mid-major by the time he graduates.
Sure. You know, he was a Notre Dame – you know, he's kind of in that around the same size as Drew Pine, really about the same skill set. Stronger arm, probably, but
– also doesn't have the game experience at this point, so that puts Pine ahead of him exponentially.
All he played in last year was the Pittsburgh game. The year before that, he played some snaps against Bowling Green and New Mexico. So, yeah.
He's never had big game experience.
And then you've got, you know, more young studs because the quarterback – recruits are getting better now for Notre Dame every year. So I didn't see him making a dent in terms of the depth chart. So
I don't
think
he saw himself making a dent. No, that's kind of the problem.
Sometimes it's just, you know, because sometimes you look at a guy who transfers and it's like, oh, he can't handle the competition or whatever. There's just there was just no path for Brendan Clark to find his way to the top of the depth chart, I don't think, here.
I think he had a shot, too, before he was injured, and he didn't make
it
then.
And that's the shame. That's the shame of things. Is if he hadn't been injured and he was able to practice in the spring, he would have got some of those reps. Who knows? But
sure. But then I feel like at this point, like, not it's a business at this point.
Yeah.
He was injured. He didn't get the reps.
But then again,
he's not the guy that's going to be able to get on the field.
Yeah.
So, and when he does get on the field, it's against scrub defenses, like backup for the blowout game.
Right.
So, like, you don't need that guy out there.
What are you going to get out of it?
Yeah. It's like a Hendricks situation.
Yeah.
Andrew Hendricks.
Yeah. Good one. Do you buy or sell Brian Kelly's decision to stick with Jack Cohn as the starter?
I would buy this more if you sold it to me as Jack Cohn as the closer instead of the starter. Because he has been pretty good in the last quarter, last couple drives.
Right.
As a starter, I guess, because he's earned it by the way he ends games. It's kind of, I don't know if you're a big golf guy, but if you golf.
I'm not.
The last hole, you always play the best, and that makes you come back again to play golf, and then you start
gives
terrible.
You that adrenaline. It's like, man, I didn't finish bad. It's
you know what? This game isn't. So like, I feel like that's what Cohn is right now.
It was only 7 strokes instead of 10.
Right, but Cohn's got to be that guy right now because he started terrible against Virginia Tech, like epically terrible. But then the way he finished and brought him back for the win, you kind of got to give it to him.
See, and that's – Brian Kelly was asked, how do you get Jack Cohn to play like that as opposed to like that? You know, like,
right.
How do you get him to play like the Jack
Fourth
Cohn at
quarter.
The end of Virginia Tech as opposed to Jack Cohn at the beginning of Virginia Tech? And now I'll say one thing, because going into that game after Cincinnati, when they stuck Tyler Buchner in there just to run a couple times and, you know, like slowed down the momentum of a drive or two, I said, if they're not going to expand the Tyler Buchner package, there's no sense in running him out there anymore. So what did they do?
They brought in Jack Cohn.
They actually expanded the Tyler Buchner package.
Sure, against Virginia
Tech. He threw.
Yeah.
Yeah, he ran a reel off. Yeah, the next game. But that's – my point is
– but that didn't last long either.
Well, but that's – I mean, that's
– you had to try it.
It's part of why he's not out there more, because he's a freshman and – he doesn't know enough yet. You know, he got fooled reading some defenses and that kind of stuff. And you've got other freshmen like Deion Colsey, the wide receiver out there. And so when you've got freshmen and freshmen, you're going to have some misreads and miscues.
Right.
And that's what happens. I mean, that's why, as talented as he is, that's why he can't be out there for a full game, because those things are going to happen. He's not quite there as a passer yet. But my bigger point is they were willing – not just his running ability is what helped him run the ball. It was when he aired it out to Kevin Austin and he hit that deep shot. Then all of a sudden, boom, that opened some things up. So they did something different. They didn't just say, okay, here's the Tyler Buchner running package. Here's Tyler Buchner actually running at least a chunk of the playbook, actual plays out of the playbook. So my point is, if they're willing to make that adjustment with Tyler Buchner, they see what they got out of Jack Cohn at the end of the game and they want to stick with Jack Cohn. I think just listening to Brian Kelly yesterday, they know they've got to tweak some things. One, Jack Cohn has to play better and do some things differently, but two, they've got to operate differently offensively at the start of the game. It can't just be what we've seen, because if it's going to be Jack Cohn try to stand in the pocket, go through all these progressions, you're going to get more sacks. Jack Cohn's got to get into a rhythm, got to get the ball out quicker. They've got to do some things differently. So if they're willing to do that, I think it can work. But I tend to agree with what your first comment was, that like it made probably more sense for Buchner to be the starter and Cohn to come in, you know, late or in 2-minute situations, whatever, if they were going to do things exactly the way that they have been doing things. But I think it makes sense for Cohn to start if they're willing to tweak some things.
But also, like, I know there's tape on everybody at this point.
Right.
But what are the odds that, like, all right, we named Jack Cohn the starter. All right, so Notre Dame's going in.
And now it's
going
to be Buchner?
but, like, let Cohn go. And if he does catch fire or he is starting hot.
You just ride it.
Ride it. But then also, you know, you have this guy coming in off the bench. There's a whole different package. And on top of it, they're expanding that package. So I'm not saying the running game necessarily. Mm-hmm. That's not what I'm saying. I'm just saying you have a different, fresh quarterback that comes in. And Kelly, like I said, he's always had two quarterbacks. Like, that's been how his mantra has been. He doesn't mind switching it up.
Right.
And so Ian Book got his start. I mean, it's fine. So now you bring in Buckner. Now that changes the game, but the team might have been set up for Cone, and now they're not. So, like, even if he's just a figurehead to start, knowing you're going to bring in Buckner, knowing that you're bringing in these packages and expanding it at practice every week, but calling him the backup, that still gives you an advantage over the, you know, incoming defense maybe. That could be a thought.
When they go to the changeup, basically, is what you're saying. Yeah, I can see
that. So, like, it's almost like, oh, it's like, I think of it in baseball terms, but, like, here's our starter, blah, blah. As soon as he, like, allows a base runner, we're going to put this guy in. And the other team's kind of been focused on Cone.
Maybe so Jack Cone's just the opener.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah, I guess. He's – and, you know, but then –
if you're going to go the baseball.
But
analogy.
Then, like, against Virginia Tech, he was the opener, and then he was the closer.
Right.
But it worked. And, like, I don't know.
It worked in the end.
But was that because you changed it to Buckner, who got a momentum, and then when he started to get stale, you switched back to
him? Well, and one of the things Brian Kelly said was, hey, you know.
Hot hand.
You're late in the game. Virginia Tech's been chasing Buckner around. Your defensive linemen are tired. All those things I think are true. But, you know, part of the thing is also.
Sounds great when it works.
Well, part of the thing is also you're playing more prevent defense at the end of the game. They're playing more zone. Well, they're not as aggressive coming after Jack Cone, because I don't think they blitzed him at all on those last two drives. Or if they did, it was obviously ineffective because he got it out quicker. But that's part of my point, too. That's part of why, you know, well, USC and anybody else isn't going to just sit there and play soft zone at the start of a game. They're going – that's
– right.
You know, just like look back at Nick Foles last year, mm-hmm. when he came in and led the comeback against Atlanta. Nick Foles never looked like that again the rest of the year.
No, he's had like five good games that made his career.
As much as the Bears tried, like, they could never replicate that. So that's kind of, you know, my thinking. Can Notre Dame actually replicate what they got at the end of the game out of Jack Cone? Because, again, teams are playing you different at the end of the game. And, yeah, and all those things come into play as well. Fatigue and all those things that Brian Kelly was talking about.
But, like, and this is such a stupid sports question to ask, but I'm going to ask you. Do you think Notre Dame won that game or Virginia Tech lost that game? Because Virginia Tech had every possibility to win or at least go to overtime, and they kind of blew it at the end.
And I'm not just looking at this from a, you know, like a slanted perspective. I do think Notre Dame won it.
Okay.
Because
and I was saying it could be either
because
way.
Because of the places that the two programs are in right now. There's a reason Notre Dame has beaten 36 consecutive unranked teams.
Right.
And, you know, it's something else that we've taught. And Virginia Tech. But that's the longest active streak in the nation right now against unranked teams. Notre Dame has the longest active streak with wins over unranked teams right now because of the place that they're in as a program. And it's like they were able to overcome some deficiencies because of the state of their program. Virginia Tech.
Which they wouldn't have done 10 years ago.
Exactly. Or even five years ago, 2016. Yeah, right. They lost those games in 2016.
Well, that's what I was going to say to you is, like, they could have lost that Purdue game. I mean, that was a little bit of a
they could
handling.
Have lost. They could easily
they could have
be
lost
0-6
Toledo.
Right
they could
now.
Have lost Florida State. They could have lost any. And they lost only Cincinnati.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. To that point, it's like, man, that team wouldn't have won any of those games 5 years ago.
That's right. That's
so,
exactly
like, to
right.
To your point, to the program just being better and being, I mean, it's like, are they?
There's a different mindset, and, like, even though it can get cliche at times to hear Brian Kelly talk about traits and all these different things, there's definitely a different mindset that they have right now.
And they are better.
Yeah, and they have better players on, you know, and that's part
better
of it
talent.
As well. They have better players, better talent, all those things.
Well, I think that's all of it.
And
better
for the
talent.
Most part, they're better coached. Now, there's still deficiencies that we know about, and, you know, they kind of got bit with a couple of things, but
I think what's interesting to watch as they've developed over the years, now you're talking about a team that can win the close games at the end, which if you talk to people 25 years old and younger, mm-hmm. they would say, oh, Notre Dame just breaks my heart every game. And now that's not the case. They've been winning those games. They've been winning those toss-ups. The only thing they right. still have, the only enigma they have, is winning the big game.
Yeah. Because, like, even like if you even go back to the different coaching staffs, whether it's Weiss or Willingham or Davey before Brian Kelly, that's the reason that you had, like, 10-2, 9-3 one year, and then 500 the next, because –
well,
they weren't in that. The foundation was not nearly as solid as the foundation that they have right now.
That's absolutely right. But then also it wasn't 10-5, then 500. It was 10-5 and then less than 500.
Right.
And then a 500 year, and now you're out the door.
Right. Exactly.
But now they've solidified their roster. They've solidified their recruiting. They've solidified their talent pool to be so much better. And we've talked about this before, but like besides Alabama and Clemson, maybe Ohio State and Oklahoma, what programs had more success over the last 10, 15 years?
Well, 10 to 15, that might be stretching it a little bit.
10 years.
See, now, off the top of my head, I mean, you could probably, like, if you're going to go back 10 years, you could probably include Oregon in there.
That's a fair one, yeah.
Again, you could include Florida State, but that is, like, heavy on early, you know, the Jimbo Fisher. You know, before Jimbo Fisher,
but they went
left.
To a playoff with undefeated 12-0 as a 3 seed because they knew they weren't good, and then they got smoked in the Rose Bowl.
Yeah, because
by that
they had
Oregon
won a national championship
the year before.
You know, yeah, exactly.
Which national championship that deserves it? Auburn, you could argue.
Yeah, again,
they won a championship.
But if you put Auburn in there again, that's going to be
anyway. The point
the
is
early part of the decade.
The point is being is that Notre Dame is a lot better.
They're
recently
than
people realize.
They're top 10 in terms of consistency over that period.
And recruiting and everything else. Building up their talent pool.
I would agree with that.
Yeah.
I was just trying to think. Like, again, like Stanford, the early part of that team, like the last, really since Notre Dame has overtaken. Yeah.
How many playoffs has Stanford made?
I'm not talking about – you're talking about a 10-year period, though. Are we talking about wins or are we talking about playoffs?
Well, I think either one. I think Notre Dame, what was their last – what was their worst year in the last 10? Because if you look
– 4-8.
And what year was that?
2016.
All right.
And so before that, they
were
like
that was the year they had a good year.
12-0.
Yeah. And that was the Deshaun Kizer era, and then he kind of flamed out in the pros. But Stanford – they were a pushover for a few years. They had Andrew Luck and
they were a pushover for a long time. Yeah. But we're talking about the last 10 years.
Well, I'd definitely put Notre Dame over Stanford if that's what we're getting at.
Well, so would I.
Well, you mentioned Stanford.
But
so.
You said
yeah.
Who else
no,
is
I don't
in
mind
that conversation?
Saying it. I'd still
I'm just
say,
talking about other teams that would be in that conversation.
Sure, but
I'm not
I was
saying
still,
they're ahead of Notre Dame.
I was still just I think
but
it's,
for a while Stanford was ahead of Notre Dame because they were going to Orange Bowls and you know, Rose Bowls and bigger bowl games when Notre Dame was still fluctuating a little bit. Like the early part of the Kelly era was the peak of the Shaw era at Stanford, whereas the last 5 years, Stanford has dipped back down and Notre Dame is head and shoulders ahead of where Stanford is.
Absolutely. And that Tulsa loss.
But again, you
that
said
Tulsa
10
loss,
years.
That hurts a lot, you know.
Well, yeah. And that's when Stanford was good.
But I still think, because you saw them building, and that wasn't Kelly's players yet. That was still early in his era.
I'm not sure what we're even arguing about right now.
I just like arguing with you. I want whatever you say, I want to take the other side. Just
I knew. Okay, 2011, Stanford 11-2.
Okay.
2012, 12-2. And Notre Dame was 12-0. Well, 12-1 they ended up
0-12.
That year. 2013, 11-3. Stanford went to the Rose Bowl. Notre Dame was in the Pinstripe Bowl. That year, 2014, 8-5, 2015, and that's around, you know, Notre Dame, I think was like 9-3 maybe that year. 2015, 12-2, Notre Dame was decent that year. They were in the playoff
was
conversation
that the one,
for a while.
Is that the one they beat LSU in the bowl game?
Yes.
No, yes. That was? Okay.
Yes. And then.
Which is a
no,
big win.
No. That
no,
was
that
2017,
yeah.
I'm sorry. 2016, Stanford was 10-3. So, like, you look at from 11 to 16, Stanford is averaging better than 10 wins per year. 2017, 9-5. 2018, 9-4. And now the last 3 years, 4-8, 4-2. They're 3-4 so far this year. So again, like if we're talking, because like it goes Fiesta, Rose, Foster Farms, Rose.
Foster Farms.
You know, everyone's got to have their Foster Farms year.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But like,
those don't even count.
But they also won a Rose Bowl. They've won two Rose Bowls.
Oh, who cares?
But because Notre Dame still has not won a, you know, what we now call a New Year's Six Bowl. Notre Dame has still not won that, whereas Stanford has won two of them.
Well, that's a.
But again, Bobby,
that argument,
you're the one that opened it up to 10 years.
Sure, and I'm not
so
backing down from
it
because I was still like the way that
right
was
now,
trending
there's
for
no
them.
Doubt that Notre Dame is better than Stanford. But over the 10
the way
year
that
period,
it was trending for them
even.
Went down. The way that's trending for Notre Dame was a little solidified, and now even up, maybe an uptick.
Right.
This year, maybe being the down year, and they still only have one loss. And I don't know. Like you talk about winning bowl games, yeah, it's harder to win those New Year's Six bowls because one, you have to be in them. Two, you're playing against teams that are in the top 10 in the whole country.
Right. I just want to remind you that this conversation started with, do you buy or sell Brian Kelly's decision to stick with Jack Cohn as Notre Dame's starting quarterback?
I buy. I think you leave him in until
right.
he proves
I've
he can't do
I've got
do
a question
it.
Or two I want to get in here, but we're going to run out of time pretty soon. So we better take a break because I want to definitely get this White Sox question in for
oh,
you here
God.
Before we wrap it up
All right.
tonight. All right, we'll do that when Rapid Fire continues.
Glad I got my voice back this week.
Yeah, definitely. That's right. yeah, I knew something sounded different.
Yeah.
All right, Budweiser's Weekday Sports Beat. Rapid Fire and Budweiser's Weekday Sports Beat continue on Sports Radio 960 AM WSBT with Bobby Hensley, Sean Stiers. How you doing?
Doing great. How you doing?
All right. You got your Sox hat on backwards, so I'm going to ask you a White Sox question.
Love the White Sox.
Sox pitcher Carlos Rodon, he's a free agent in the offseason. How much of a priority should re-signing him be?
Zero. I think that guy, you got all you could out of him during the regular season. But he was tanked by the end. He took a time on the IL to try and recover to come back for the playoffs.
Is
it didn't
that,
work.
Here's my
and
go ahead. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No. I was gonna say, and then the White Sox have a cakewalk of a division anyway. So you don't need your fourth or fifth starter to be him. Because he started out the year gangbusters. But you don't need that all year if you're the White Sox, because you're more focused on getting to the postseason.
Here's my
you
question.
Need to be built for October.
He had a great year.
He had a throat.
By the end, he was obviously worn out.
Mm-hmm.
Here's my question. Should Carlos Rodon, coming off surgery, he's had Tommy John and shoulder surgery in April, should he have averaged 104 pitches per game in his four April starts?
I know where you're getting at here. And
my question
and no,
is, could they have done a better job?
Well,
could they have done a better job of – you know,
absolutely. But how hard is it to pull a guy that has a no-hitter into the sixth inning?
Okay, that's once, though.
But he had three of them into the seventh.
Okay. Well,
which I know that doesn't change his average for the year.
If it's April,
right.
For me, it wouldn't be a tough decision at all because you've got to do what's best for your team, not only
right.
in that moment,
especially
but
when
for the course of the season. And he's got the history that he's got.
Especially when you're well, yeah, his history. I wouldn't have even started him the first 2 months.
So I guess
I would have put him on a delayed start even.
Or even, you know, we talked about Tony LaRusso. You can still pitch him, but there are other things you can do.
Well,
like how about a Tampa Bay Rays approach where maybe, you know, again, they're not going to get knee deep in the analytics and all that stuff, but how about an opener when Carlos Rodon pitches
well and they have
and
one.
then cap him at maybe 90 pitches or oh, five innings whichever 80. Comes first
right
well even that I'm
because
just saying there are other things that you can do and so the White Sox desperately need pitching. They found that out in their series against Houston, right? So I mean,
but
signing him to a big multi-year contract,
well,
that would
not
be a priority.
No,
but whether it's him or somebody else, they need pitching. And if you're going to sign Carlos Rodon, I think that there are things that you can do to work around that.
You
because
sign
other
him.
Teams, if Tampa Bay can figure out pitching, then the genius should be able to figure out pitching, right?
Okay.
And his boss should be able to figure out pitching.
So I almost think what the Sox should do, if you want to re-sign Rodon to a couple-year deal, incentive-based, switch him and Michael Kopech. Because Kopech can be a starter.
I agree.
So you could almost make Kopech and like on that pitch count, give him 80 pitches, give Rodon 80 pitches and pair them as a starter in a middle relief.
Yeah.
And, like, that would be a unit for you.
Yeah.
And then you bring in your closer or your bullpen like normal. But these two could.
And then at the end of the season, you've got both of them, whatever right. you need to do.
And then on top of that, you have Giolito, you have Keuchel, you have Lance Lynn, if he's going to hang on, which I don't know if that's going to. Like, he had an outstanding year, but I don't think you count on that happening again. But if you paired Kopech and Rodon, it doesn't matter which one starts, which one's second, because Kopech's never been a starter since he got hurt.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he hasn't been the guy. He's pitched a couple of games and doubleheaders and whatnot, which are only seven innings. So, but I think that guy.
That's an interesting. You know, you still have to address other things. But so you're saying, like, piggyback those guys.
Well, Kopech isn't going to be your middle relief guy forever. He's a stud. That mm-hmm. was, it was Kopech and Moncada they got for Chris Sale. So if you aren't going to use him as a starter or put him in a role, because you don't need him as a closer, which he would be good at. But you're not going to use him as
well,
that.
Part of the thing is starting pitching is
premium.
Well, it's de-emphasized, though, right now. There are a handful of premier guys, but with all of these
funny.
Guys, look at all the teams in the playoffs and look at who's going past six innings and who's going past three times through the rotation.
Well,
virtually nobody is doing it.
In the postseason, that's a whole different talk. Because, like, in the regular season.
Even in the regular season,
like,
they're not going
the
past six anymore.
The Yankees had the best ace in baseball, arguably, in Gerrit Cole.
Right.
Who was there, too? Luis Severino, who was on the IL the whole year. They didn't have a number two, but they weren't hurting that much until the end because they were still in playoff contention. They still went on their streaks. They still went on their things. Who's Boston's best three pitchers? Who's anybody's? Like, none of the starting pitching matters.
But that's because those organizations look at pitching differently. And that's my point. Those two organizations, the Tampa Bay Rays, the Dodgers, all the Giants, like who's the Giants' best pitcher and look how many games they won. It's because
zero in the playoffs.
Yep. Well, they won a couple games in the playoffs. They just didn't win a series because they had to play the team with the next most wins,
right.
You know?
Which was an unfair, almost. Yeah.
Exactly. But my point is, if you're going to approach pitching from a 1980s perspective, the way the White Sox are right now, you're going to get 1980s results. Because everyone else is doing it differently, and all the teams that are still playing in the playoffs right now, they don't have that much better, starting, overall pitching than everybody else, but look at where they are right now.
Well, you got Tony La Russa, who's just,
that's my point,
out of touch, and then you have Dusty Baker, who's kind of out of touch.
But
and look at those.
But I mean, the reason Dusty Baker can succeed is because
the Astros are good.
Well, because the front office is handing him data. He's a middle manager, is what he is. But you don't hire Tony La Russa to be a middle manager. You hire him for other.
Yeah, because you made
reasons.
A mistake 40 years ago, and now
that's
you got to
right. Put
him in. But no, so that's the thing with La Russa, the way he mismanaged the bullpen, because we talked last week, if you bring in one of the best closers in Kimbrel, and you already have one in Hendricks, you can just separate them by a day.
Yeah.
And you have Tapera, you have Kopech, they should be able to split the bullpen even, so like you have almost like your starter, almost like your starting
right. Bullpen. You didn't have to have...
And he didn't do
this. This is my closer. This is my eighth inning guy. It didn't have to be that. They could both be ninth inning guys, like you said, on different days.
And you could almost give them two inning saves or something because they're both so good. And none of that happened.
Yep, I agree. All right, got to wrap things up. Good stuff as always. I will talk to you next week.
Yeah, I hope.
Enjoy.
Or third. Yeah, next week. Next week.
Budweiser's Weekday Sports Beat is brought to you by Budweiser, the king of beers, locally distributed by United Beverage Company of South Bend. Football fans, this Bud's for you. Excuse me, the Food Bank of Northern Indiana. Hunger is a story we can end. Find out how at feedindiana.org. Tim Grau State Farm Insurance, Midland Engineering Company, the Mishawaka Education Foundation, Barnaby's of Mishawaka and Granger, Fisher's Barbecue and Catering, South Bend Orthopedics, Wings Etc. Grill and Pub, Four Winds Casino, and Legacy Heating and Air. For Bobby Hensley, I am Sean Stiers. Talk to you tomorrow on Budweiser's Weekday Sports Beat.